bomb was thrown into the car. Israeli media say that tracks were found leading from the site of the incident to a nearby settlement. At least two of the injured are children and are being treated in a Jerusalem hospital. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denounced the attack, saying, quote, "This is a grave incident. We will do all we can to try and catch those responsible and bring them to justice." The military says it is searching for the culprits. Human rights groups here say, though, that attacks by Jewish settlers in the West Bank on Palestinians are on the rise, and virtually nothing is done to bring those responsible to justice. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
Major League Baseball has given its okay to the sale of the San Diego Padres. The price, $800 million. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items to remember special days with personalized huggies, keychains, cameras, and more. A complete online catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In the United States and in other affluent nations, there are growing numbers of young adults, people in their 20s and 30s, who are living with their parents. Our guest for this hour, sociologist Catherine Newman, says that while this kind of doubling up has long been seen in families that were less well off, the middle class has never before needed to provide this kind of long-term economic safety net for their grown children. In this hour of our show, we'll be talking about this change with Catherine Newman. She is a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and she's the author of a recent book that we'll discuss. The title of her book is The Accordion Family, the subtitle Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. Beacon Press is the publisher on the book, and it tries to take a look at the ways that global economic conditions have redefined family life. Our guest, Catherine Newman, is the author of 10 books dealing with middle-class economic instability, urban poverty, and the sociology of inequality. She has been a guest on this program before, also on our afternoon magazine show, and you can find several past conversations with her on our web archive, if you would like to do that. And Professor Newman, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Good. Well, we appreciate you, again, giving us some of your time. And I think that maybe a place to start, or something to kind of underline here, is that while certainly we have read and heard a lot about this, popular media has covered this phenomenon in the United States, that the United States is not the only place where this is happening.
Not only that, we're not even the most extreme place, not by a long shot. This trend is far more pronounced in countries in Western Europe like Spain and Italy and Portugal. And in Japan, we're really in the middle, somewhere between the Nordic countries where this phenomenon of what I call the accordion family is almost non-existent, and countries like Japan where it's far more pronounced and has been going on for a much longer period of time.
And what's really quite fascinating here, I'm sure we'll talk about it, is that so not only do you see it other places and the extent of the phenomenon might be greater, but as you go from one place to the next, as you did, and ask people how they feel about it, what they think about it, there is a great difference between those places like Japan, for example, where they think this is a really serious problem, to other places where, well, maybe they don't think it's such a big deal.
Yeah, that's what interested me most of all and caused me to write this book in the first place, which is that the demographic patterns are pretty much the same in many of these countries, but the cultural attitudes and the political reactions are completely different. And that has to do with the history of these countries and the way they think about life in general. So in Italy, the tendency was for most ordinary people that we interviewed to think there wasn't any problem here at all. They like having their children home. They're not bothered by the fact that they're reaching up into their 30s. The government is hysterical about it, but the ordinary people seemed not to be. All the way to Japan, where it really was approaching a social catastrophe in the view of most ordinary Japanese people. who saw this as emblematic of a kind of defective generation that they had somehow raised, and was creating a sense of self-doubt and self-criticism throughout the culture. So the very same demographic trend producing very different social and political reactions.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's perhaps that's not real surprising, or at least it can be explained by looking at cultural differences. But it is really striking that, say, for example, to talk some more about Japan, that the Japanese should think that if there are 20-year-old people who are living with their parents, that it means that the Japanese would think that it means there's something wrong with the child, but also that ultimately that reflects on the parents that they should raise such a child.
What I found remarkable about Japan is that there's no shortage of news in the Japanese press about the 20-year economic stagnation of the country. But that explanation for what has happened to the opportunity structure for young people almost never surfaced in any of the interviews in which parents were asked why they thought their children were still at home with them. So the same information about the economic structure in which the country is embedded didn't penetrate into their cultural explanations of why their children have turned out the way they have, or what is wrong with the Japanese family. And nobody thought there was anything wrong with the Italian family. And in Spain, the very same demographics produced a sense of anger and frustration at government, at elites, at big business, but it was never about defects in the next generation.
That's really striking that one of the big differences is, as you engage people and get them to talk about this, is where it is they place the blame, and that there are some places where they tend much more to place the blame on the individual and maybe say, well, that's just because that person's not motivated, that they don't work hard. And then other places where not only do they place it outside the individual and they recognize there are economic factors going here, but that there should be a place, as you say, a place like Spain, where people are angry about this, but they're not angry with their children. They're angry with their government.
Exactly. So therein lies the great value of looking at a problem like this across a large landscape and not simply focusing on our own country, where we have our own ways of thinking about these things, but recognizing this as a worldwide phenomenon in the industrial and post-industrial affluent countries, and one which we're all coming to grips with as a consequence of globalization and increasing competition that's affecting youth labor markets, and not even such young youth anymore either. In Japan, we're talking about people who are cresting into their 40s now.
Hmm. Is it really possible to come down to make some kind of definitive statement about what's going on here and, in a sense, take a position between those two points and saying, well, on the one hand, that there's something wrong with us or our children, and on the other hand, saying, no, it's not that they're not smart. It's not that they're not motivated. It's not that they're not working hard. It's not that we didn't send them to a good college, that it's just a terribly, terribly tough economic time to be in. And that's really what the issue is. Is that indeed what the issue is?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. This trend long predates the recession. The recession certainly is making it worse. But the tendencies that we're pushing toward multi-generational households of the kind I've written about in this book go back long before this. They go back at least to the mid-1980s, when we start to see the liberalization of labor markets, the emergence of short-term part-time jobs, the increasing expectations for education in professional labor markets that has become more and more expensive. Those trends actually began long before the recession. But it is certainly true that this punishing recession has made things much, much worse and accelerated a tendency that was already there. I do think there are these sort of secular long-term trends going on that we need to pay attention to as sort of original movers. But there's no question that we are facing true catastrophes for youth employment now. And they're not so youthful either. And it will therefore affect the long-term trajectory of these generations as they move into adulthood or some facsimile of adulthood.
Yeah. And this is, I hesitate to use the cliche term new normal, but that's the best I can come up with. Do you, in fact, think that's the direction that we're going, and that people will come to consider this to be more the norm in the future?
I think we already are thinking of it that way. It's one of the things that interests me as a social scientist is how the new normal gets born. What happens when you have two generations side by side with very different economic histories that surrounded their coming of age? And that's more or less what we're looking at now. But this is such a pronounced trend for young people, with over 50% of the nation's college graduates headed home, that I don't think the stigma can persist. It's too common, it's too universal for it to be a strongly stigmatized condition for much longer. As to whether or not we're ever going to see the end of this, well, I'm sure if we ever come out of this economic slump, some of the pressures will recede, but not the long-term pressures I spoke about a moment ago. We will still be looking at extraordinary demands for higher education, which is expensive. More and more young people asked to work for nothing as interns in order to gain experience to access the professional labor market they're interested in. And I don't think those things are going to go away, even if the economy recovers to a strong level.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus. Catherine Newman is professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and we are talking about some of what you'll find in her recent book, The Accordion Family. The subtitle is Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. Beacon Press is the publisher, and it takes a look at this growing phenomenon, something that you see in the United States, but not just in the United States, also in other developed countries, this phenomenon of adults, and we're talking about here people in their 20s and 30s living with their parents. And what she did was that she spent time talking with people in a number of places around the world just to get a sense of how they thought about this, and as she has explained here, the reaction to it and whether people think it's a problem or not varies a great deal from place to place. Questions, again, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think for us here in the United States, we you know, we have notoriously short memories. They only manage to go back a few decades. Do you think that it is the case that if we somehow think that it should be the norm, or it was always the norm, that, say, people in their late teens or early 20s at latest would move out of their parents' homes, would start their own homes, would get married, would start families, would start into careers, and that, in fact, that's a relatively recent phenomenon, something that was made possible by the post-war economic boom, and that actually before World War II, even in the middle class, that it wasn't that common?
That's exactly right. We do have very short memories, and I think there's a reason for this. We tend to think of the normal as having been defined by the experience of the largest living generations. And of course, right now, the largest living generation, the baby boomers, did come of age at a time when it was possible for people to move, and they did move out from underneath their parents, establish homes away from their families, had a period of time on their own before they married, a considerable period of time, and then later married. But it was economically possible for them to do that, and normatively expected at the age of 18. But that was a set of economic conditions that has not been repeated since, and certainly is not the way we would characterize the current moment. So what we think of as normal is the experience of this huge generation. But if we go back one generation before that to their parents, the generation that sort of came of age just before around the Second World War, the common practice was to stay home until you got married. And the age of marriage before the Second World War was averaged at around 25, 26, something like that. Well, we're back up to that now. It dropped way down after the Second World War. The age of marriage for women dropped down to, like, I think it was 21 or 22, and for men it was like 24, and it has steadily crept back up to where it was before. So we've sort of gone through a great U-turn, if you will, and we're back up to a pattern that's not all that unfamiliar to people who came of age before the Second World War. But it has been so long the norm for young people to leave at 18 and be on their own that we're having trouble assimilating this new normal for what it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, you explained that you talked to people in Japan, for example, about this phenomenon and found out that there in Japan, people are very worried about this. They think that it's a very serious problem. They think that it reflects badly on people who are still living with their parents and their family. It's something, it's certainly not something to be proud of as far as the Japanese are concerned. In fact, if you have a 20-year-old child living with you, that's something to be ashamed of. So that's sort of one pole. Then also, then on the other end of the spectrum, you have a place like Italy where apparently they don't really get very exercised about this at all. And they don't think that it's a huge problem. There is one other place I also think is really interesting that you looked at that we haven't talked about, and that's Scandinavia. So, and there is yet another difference there on how it is that people think about this. What's their attitude towards this?
Well, it doesn't exist in Scandinavia very much. And that's really, I found that a really interesting observation because the Scandinavians have just as much trouble in the youth labor markets as the rest of these industrial countries, affluent countries. So why are they not seeing accordion families? Why are their young people still able to leave home at a fairly young age? And the answer is that their political structures and their systems of redistribution are so much more generous that it's not necessary for the family to step in to protect young people from the ravages of the market. They have an extremely extensive safety net. It is composed of extraordinary contributions by our standards to higher education, which is nearly free, to unemployment, which is generous, lasts a long time, and is given to people who haven't held jobs at all. It has extraordinary housing benefits, very, very large rental sector, much of which is state-owned and therefore controlled prices at a low level. All of these aspects of the Scandinavian safety net mean that the family doesn't really have to step in and protect the younger generation. If you are 16 years old and interested in studying in a specialized high school in some other city than the one where you were born, the state will help you find housing, put you on a stipend, and facilitate that move at the age of 16. So if we contrast that to a country like Spain, where there's virtually no money for student financial aid, no dormitories, young people stay at their parents' home throughout their college years if they go to college at all, we're looking at two very different configurations of the safety net. So in countries with very strong welfare states, which is the characteristic signature of the social democracies in the Nordic countries, you don't see accordion families at all. So the accordion family is very much a reflection of the extent to which the state steps in to cure the problems that have emerged in the market. And that's true in Scandinavia, and it's definitely not true in Spain. And we are somewhere in the middle in the United States.
Mm-hmm. We also mentioned, have touched on the fact that that perhaps on the lower end of the economic scale that accordion families have existed for a long time, and maybe they always did, and that in fact there probably would have been a time that it would have been more common in middle-class families as well, that we had this blip, this economic blip right after World War II that made it possible for people to have a kind of financial independence that they hadn't had before at a relatively young age. But having said all that, going back to the idea of poor or working class accordion families, are the issues there the same as they are with today's middle class families that are going through the same thing, or is it somehow different?
Well, there are, as you might not be surprised to hear, both similarities and differences. It's absolutely true that those at the bottom end of the economic spectrum in the United States have long had accordion families, still do, and sadly probably always will, because they face such extraordinary challenges to survival from month to month and often have to pull in the contributions of their adult children to the central household coffers just to make it, just to pay the rent over the heads of the entire extended family. So among immigrant families, the accordion family is very common. Among the native-born poor, it's very common. And it's that way because they require pooled income just to manage. And hence, they face somewhat of an opposite cultural problem, if you will. Among many of the poor families I've studied, when their children are of an age when they're really anxious to move out on their own and start their own families, they will face a kind of pressure not to to stay home with their parents in order to hold that income inside one household. It becomes a bit of a threat to the survival of the whole family when able-bodied working young people move out. And so this is one of those bizarre contradictions in which for the working class, young people tend not to go away to school anyway. Their families can't afford it. It takes much longer for them to finish their education anyway. And for the very poor, their families almost need them to stay put indefinitely. They don't, but the tensions are extraordinary when they want to move out.
I'd like to have you talk a little bit about family dynamics here and how it is that having a 20-something child living with you affects family dynamics. And I'm sure that, again, that goes back, it would have to go back to how it is you feel about that in the first place. So, you know, for example, say in Japanese families, how's everybody getting along?
It's a matter of great tension in Japanese families, more than any of the other countries that I studied. There is tremendous tension and disapproval, and often among the young, a sense of self-disapproval as well, I'm sorry to say. That is, they often don't disagree that much with their parents and look at themselves as defective, which is pretty staggering. Being unwilling to recognize, in a sense, the role that the economy is playing in their fate, all across the board, across the generations. In the United States, what I tended to find was that if relations were good before this young person moved out and went off to college or into the labor force, they're pretty good when they come back as well. In fact, they might be even better, because what you're receiving back into the household is a sort of new and improved version of the child you let go in the first place. So they come back better educated, more like their parents in many ways, less in need of the sort of surveillance and discipline that is characteristically a problem between parents and their teenage kids. So what comes back is this young adult who doesn't need the kind of negative or tension-producing aspects of parenting, and instead preserves all the pleasant aspects. They can do things together with their parents. They often have very similar tastes in movies or music. As I've often joked with other people, if you go to a Rolling Stones concert, you'll see two kinds of people in the audience, gray hairs and their children. There's remarkable continuity in their cultural tastes. That's a big difference from the way the baby boom saw their parents. There was tremendous tension across those generational boundaries. And of course, we remember this when we speak of that phrase, that ubiquitous phrase, the 60s, which represented this cultural rebellion. Well, we don't see much cultural rebellion now. Young people who are in their mid-20s and their parents are often on very much the same wavelength. So the fact that they don't need surveillance and they're on the same wavelength, and the fact that their parents, mothers and fathers, worked all the way through their childhood, and hence weren't really sick of them at 18 when they left home, but in fact missed them, means that the cohabitation works reasonably smoothly as long as everyone can see an end in sight, as long as they know that this is something that's going to change in the future when the young people are able to find the opportunities that everyone thinks they ought to have.
And maybe it's not the case that we have come to a point yet where people are really starting to question whether there is an end in sight, and that everybody is now just hopeful, and maybe not without reason, that in another 5 years or 10 years, the kids are not still going to be there.
Well, I don't know if hopeful is the word I would use. Certainly they have, they are expecting that this will not be a permanent condition. Now, when the economy is as desperate as it is right now and these opportunities seem to be limited and there's tremendous amounts of underemployment and downward mobility, there's a lot of anxiety. I wouldn't kid you about that. And these households certainly feel that anxiety. But one of the silver linings in this, I suppose, is that people come to recognize what families do for one another. Families are part of the safety net. They can't substitute for an economy that functions well, and they should never be asked to substitute for the things that government and communities do for their members. But they do come to recognize that parents and children stick together for a reason. It's part of what the intergenerational compact is all about. And that's not a bad thing. It's what's unfortunate is that it is so desperately needed because the opportunities are so limited. But the presence of intergenerational family bonds is not something that people need to think poorly about. In fact, ironically, I found in the Scandinavian countries where it's not really necessary, given how much support there is from the government directly to individuals, a certain lamentation about the way in which this frayed relations between the generations, that people didn't seem to need each other as much, and they wonder if they've gone overboard in that level of independence from one generation to the next. So there is a value in families recognizing that this kind of intergenerational assistance, both going down to the children and up to the grandparents, is part of what family is for. It's just unfortunate that it is being called upon to do far more than families can really do to substitute for a healthy economy or for the supports that, you know, should come from the state.
I think that Scandinavian reaction that you just touched on, I think it's really interesting that they would have gone to the trouble as a society to produce this kind of safety net, which would make it possible for someone, say, who was 18 years old, you know, to move out of the house and have some independence. And that then the Scandinavians would look at, say, the United States, where we have 20-somethings living with their families, and might almost look at that with a little bit of longing and would say to themselves, well, maybe we didn't love our children enough? Did we push them out the door? Is the fact that they're not living with us, does that say something about us as parents or our relationship with them? I think that that's very interesting. They would have that reaction.
I found it very interesting, too, and quite unanticipated. When I went to Sweden and Denmark, the two countries in the Nordic zone that are in the book, I thought I was going there to study the absence of the problem that is written throughout the rest of the book. And what I found was this almost lonely culture, this sense that people were too isolated and atomistic. And it helped me understand something I had never quite fathomed before, which was the extraordinary popularity of the Stieg Larsson novels, which, as you know, have this very dark and foreboding quality to them, a lot of which is about violence of strangers upon strangers. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered, how could a novelist like that become so popular in countries that embrace this egalitarian ideal and are all-encompassing in their social safety net? You know, this seems like perfection to an American who's used to having to worry about all the things that Scandinavians don't have to worry about at all. And yet you get this fascination with this macabre portrait of stranger violence. And it did help me understand that when I realized this fear or concern about atomistic social relations, which does seem to be much more widespread than I would ever have expected.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Catherine Newman. She is professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about her book, The Accordion Family. We'll talk more after a very short break. This is Focus.
WILL is your source for comprehensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Each night of both conventions, NPR will bring you live reports and analysis on AM 580, while the PBS NewsHour team will provide live coverage on WILL-TV. Our national convention coverage begins Monday, August 27th at 7 p.m. from the GOP National Convention in Tampa. WILL, your source for in-depth election news. You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Catherine Newman. She's professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She has authored 10 books dealing with subjects including middle-class economic instability, urban poverty, the sociology of inequality, and her most recent is titled The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. It's published by the Beacon Press and looks at this growing phenomenon. You see it in a number of developed countries, including the United States, of adults in their 20s and 30s living with their parents. And the interesting thing, as we have discussed, as she has traveled around the world talking to people in Europe, in Scandinavia, here in the United States and in Japan, that from place to place, the attitudes people have toward this vary a great deal from the Japanese, who think this is a very, very serious problem, to, say, some people in Europe, like the Italians, who think that it's not particularly a problem at all. I know, Professor Newman, that people all over the place have different ways of marking adulthood and deciding who is an adult and who is not. And I guess for us, at least in recent decades, it's all been about financial independence, whether people can support themselves, although that's maybe not the best marker of adulthood. But given now at the place we are now, is this whole business of defining adulthood going through a change?
Yes. I think it's moving from a system, if you will, that was defined by very obvious and, in a sense, objective markers: completion of education, marriage, separate households, children, to something that's more psychological. Do you feel more autonomous? Do you feel more responsible? Do you think of yourself in more mature terms? Because all those other markers are pushing out further and further into the life course. And we certainly don't look at someone who's 25 and think they're just like they were at 15. We know there's a difference there. But the difference is no longer marked by all of those objective milestones anymore. So we've sort of reverted to a psychological way of emphasizing feeling or sentiment or perspective or subjective reality than these objective markers. And I do think that's here to stay.
Hmm. I wonder how this, if it becomes more common for young adults to live with their parents, at least longer than, say, you did or I did, and that's actually, if they actually like each other, they've discovered that everybody's kind of grown up and they think, oh, this is not so bad. These people are not so bad. Is that something, I wonder, that's likely to have an effect on the lifelong relationship of parents and children, particularly when parents get older and they will then need more support from their children?
I certainly speculate on that point. It would have to be speculation because we're not there yet. But I do think that what I'm seeing in accordion families is a greater bond being built across the generations. And unless something happens to shred it, it would seem to me that that is likely to persist in and across the life course. But I can't say that I have evidence for this. I can only say that it seems reasonable to me that this period in which these generations come back together again and share a household on a more egalitarian basis, less of a parent-child hierarchy, more of a parent-child duo, or almost like a borders with benefits, that's got to have some durable consequences. I know, for example, in earlier interviews I've done on this book and on other NPR stations, I learned that there were developers in California that are now building houses that speak to this demand for multi-generational housing once again, with so-called granny apartments built into the normal nuclear family-style household. And I think once we see architecture start to reflect these bonds, we are looking at slightly more durable possible relations. We went through a long period as women went back into the labor market in large numbers of nursing home construction and independent living, or those sorts of arrangements for older people. And I'm not sure that those things are going to go away because women are still very much in the labor market. On the other hand, older people are staying active longer into the life course than they did before, too. And so it's not just what's happened to young people that's changing. The whole life course is changing. People are having babies later in life. They're becoming grandparents much later in life than they did before. They're staying in the labor market longer than they did before. We have a record number of first-time births to women over the age of 40, and we have a large proportion of people headed back into the labor market in their 70s. And what this says to me is that the life course is elongating. It's not just that young people are coming back home. That's not the only change that's going on here. There's a change going on in how parents are aging, or not, as the case may be. You know, when my mother was 50, she was pretty much done with child rearing. But I have, you know, I have had my children in and out of the house in their 20s. And that's a very different form of parenting than was true for my mother. So it's the whole family and the life course of everyone in it that's changing, not just young people.
Yeah. Well, and I certainly find myself wondering, as we look at the demographics, and we will anticipate that in the next couple of decades, you know, we'll have very significant percentages of the American population in the older age groups. And there, I think there are a lot of questions about, as a society, how do we care for these people, take care of their needs for housing and their needs for health care and various kinds of supports? And one wonders, are families going to have to come back together? They certainly are already doing that, but are they going to have to come back together in even more creative ways? And as you suggest, when you told the story about what people are looking at in terms of housing, whether in fact we might well see a much much greater move towards multi-generational families, kind of like we saw actually again going back probably before World War II.
Well, I think it's entirely possible. What moves against that model is the persistence of both parents in the labor market. It leaves very little time for the kind of sort of custodial or medical care that is needed for the very elderly. But I think that when we're talking about people in their 70s who are in good health and maybe up even into their early 80s, we may well be seeing a difference in how they are connected to their families after having gone through a long period in which sort of assisted living and nursing homes seem to have been the answer. We may be looking at a change. And, of course, all of that is affected by the economy as well. If it becomes unaffordable, as it is for poor people don't put their elderly in nursing homes. They can't afford it. So they have been in these multi-generational constructs forever. And it may be that the same kinds of economic constraints will start to creep up the economic ladder. But it's also the case that if people are aging more slowly or they're remaining active longer into their adult and very mature years, that we will see all kinds of new configurations. One thing I have learned as a social scientist is that predicting the future is really a risky business. And so all I can do is say that it seems reasonable to me that what I'm seeing in these accordion families will have long-term consequences, but it's not because I can actually prove that.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of callers we'll get right to. Let me just again very quickly tell you that the guest this morning is Catherine Newman. She is professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and we're talking about what you will find in her recent book, The Accordion Family, about this trend that we see here in the United States and a lot of other places with adult children living with their parents. We'll go to the phones here. We'll talk with someone in Atlanta, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got some comments that can be commented on. The first one is, before World War II, the population largely was in the countryside. And, of course, those families were farmers, and they wanted their kids to stay home and needed them to stay home. And, of course, then later things started moving to the city. And the one phenomenon I've noticed now talking to friends and acquaintances is the fact that I'll ask them about their kids, and they said, oh, yeah, they're doing fine and everything. And I said, well, where do they live? They said, oh, two doors away. And it turns out that probably in some cases the parents probably helped buy the house two doors away, and they seem to get along just fine. So they're really still in the same neighborhood. And the other phenomena that I noticed is that a lot of parents on retirement will move to where their kids are. And I find this is, you know, quite common. And say somebody lives in Illinois and their kids work in California or Montana or wherever it is, the parents will move there. And, you know, I find this kind of interesting, so I'm going to shut up and let you comment on those comments. Thank you.
Okay.
These are all excellent points, and they're all very true. Yes, we were much more of an agrarian nation beforehand. And, you know, who's to say whether or not that is a one-way street or a round trip? when we look at the countries that are really in economic crisis right now, and we're not even close to there, but countries like Greece, we are seeing a return to the countryside as the young people who I'm sure were never intending to have an agricultural future are returning to the land that belongs to their grandparents and trying to eke out a living because they've lost all hope in the urban areas. So, and by the way, the same thing happened in the Great Depression. During the Great Depression, millions of Americans went back to the land because that's where they could actually survive. And so we're not there yet, but every time we think we've got a fix on the future and that it was a one-way evolution in one direction, we can sometimes learn that it was a round trip and that the future looks more like the past than we expected. To the second point, this is really quite crucial. In families that are affluent, in the affluent upper middle class and beyond, you may see young people who are residentially independent, but they're not financially independent. They have, their parents may be paying their rent or subsidizing their homes or helping the next generation with a down payment or doing extensive amounts of child care, all of which are transfers of resources and labor from the older generation to the younger generation. So even independent residential settings doesn't necessarily tell us that these ties are completely broken. They may well be, in fact, quite the opposite, strong and reinforced. As we see in the third point the caller made with respect to parents migrating to where their children live, that's a very common phenomenon. And what it tells us is, you know, and this is no great shock to anyone, family matters. Family matters throughout the life course. It always has. And that there is something important about those durable ties that are both continuous and possibly become even more important when economic times get tough. The family really is the haven in the heartless world, to use Christopher Lash's famous phrase. And it matters when people are in need, whether that's an economic need or an emotional need or a support for elders.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hi, I've got sort of two thoughts here. One is it equally likely for daughters and sons to remain at home, one? And then two, the role of what the family means, and particularly the role of the mother, seems to me to vary culturally. And when you say that Italy accepts and welcomes the older kids staying home, I recall being in Italy, and our tour guide had two sons. One was in Milan, she lived in Rome. He was a very successful accountant, and the other was a professional basketball player. And so our tour guide had to rush home every Friday and do their laundry. The accountant would send it from Milan to his mom in Rome. And I tried to make a joke saying, well, in America, we have parental emancipation. We call it college. We send them away and hope they don't come back. And she was horrified at this. She said, no, I want my boys, but in fact, the pro ball player still lived with her. I want my boys at home. And then she went on to say, Italian men, at least, are known as the great lovers. But that's only for 2 weeks, because after that, they have to go home to mama. So it seems to me that maybe mothers differ somewhat and are part of this mix. So I'll hang up and listen for your comments. Thank you.
All right.
Yes, well, this cult of so-called mamismo is a matter of great teasing and some degree of consternation in Italy. In fact, at one point, as I report in the book, under Berlusconi's regime, there was an attempt to make it illegal to live at home after the age of 18, and it failed miserably because the legislator who put it forward was discovered to have lived at home till he was 30, where his mom was doing his laundry. It certainly is the case that women who define their purpose in life as mothering seem, at least in Italy, to want to hold on to that role and not to be bothered by it lasting for a very, very long time. In fact, one woman who I quote in the book, and this was part of what set me off on this whole odyssey of writing this book, said to me, well, my son's at home, he's 35, and I said, gee, that's interesting, what is it like to have your son at home at 35? And she said, well, why would he ever leave me? And I had to really recover my balance from that comment, because in the United States, if your son was home at 35, you would think you'd done something horribly wrong, but that clearly was not the case in Italy. This also helped to explain something that was very surprising to me in the Italian research, which is that I never heard any of the Italian mothers that I interviewed, who were in their 50s and late 50s even, lament the fact that they didn't have grandchildren. And this really surprised me, because this is a country famous for large families, multi-generational families. And in fact, they're not so multi anymore, because that grandchild generation isn't there. Well, why are these mothers not bothering their children to produce grandkids? And the answer is, you bother your children to have grandchildren if you aren't a mother anymore yourself. But if you're still mothering somebody at the age of 35, well, you haven't lost the social role that you try to recapture through grandparenthood. Hmm. And they haven't. They are still purposeful mothers with an important role to play, as they see it, in the social structure. And I don't know how many of them are doing long-distance laundry like that, but plenty of them are doing laundry up close because their children have not left.
We just have a couple of minutes, and I'm interested also the other question that the caller asked about. When you take a look at adult children who are returning home to live with parents, are there any significant differences between the boys and the girls, or the young men and the young women?
So here's the thing. I didn't find significant differences. I found some interesting changes, though, in what parents expect. They do expect as much of their daughters as they do of their sons with respect to finding a profession, finding their way in life, and they're just as worried about their daughters as they are their sons with respect to their long-term occupational or economic future. Hmm. So I didn't see big differences in the patterns of returning home. I did see some differences in how they behave when they're at home. It's a little bit harder, it seems, for boys to accept the responsibilities that their parents expect them to accept for taking care of their rooms and contributing to the household. That seemed to be more of a rub with boys than girls, but not hugely different, just enough for it to stick in my mind. But I think the most interesting finding for me was the convergence, not the divergence. Yeah. The convergence in what parents are expecting girls and boys to do in the world. They do not think it's okay for their daughters to not have a professional life after they've gone to college any more than they think that it's okay for their sons. It's not okay for anybody anymore.
Yeah. There's one other thing. Again, we'll have to be quick on this, but I think that there is, at least to some extent, a growing expectation, and this may, again, not spread to all economic levels, but a growing expectation that your job is not just something that you do to live, to pay the bills, but it's something that you find fulfilling. And that's not always an easy thing to do. Is some of this bound up with our acceptance of this idea that it might take you some time to figure out what it is you want to do?
It is certainly bound up in our sense of what work is for in the middle class. In fact, I found that many parents were not that fussed either way about whether or not their children made a lot of money, but they did want them to have occupations that they felt were fulfilling and that were the outcome, the natural outcome of all of this expense and effort placed on college education. So there were many kids who were interested in going into the nonprofit world where salaries are much lower, and that was fine with their parents. They had no problem with that. So this was less a matter of money alone and more a matter of meaningful work. And that, I do think, has become the new luxury, in a sense, or the new objective, which is that we hope that work will be more than a way to put a roof over our heads. Hmm. And I think if we go back two generations to the men and women, especially the men who came of age after the Second World War and the huge explosion of white-collar labor in the U.S. and the rest of the advanced industrial world, we see many men who worked in jobs that were not regarded as particularly fulfilling. They were earning a living and doing pretty well at that, able to support non-working wives and the baby boom generation, which was large. But the notion that jobs should be fulfilling is more of an invention of the late 70s and onward, and it is definitely persisted now. So that for many people, the epitome here is not just to make money. The epitome is to have a job that you can be proud of, that you think makes a difference in whatever way you define that.
Well, and again, to just as a way of wrapping up, You think that what we're looking at now is a trend that has some stability going into the future, and in fact, as we've said, it's in a sense it's also kind of rooted in the past.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I do think it's an expectation going into the future. On the other hand, sadly, the recession is going to mean that an awful lot of the nation's young people are not likely to find the kinds of jobs that genuinely give them the satisfaction they were seeking or that fully engage their capabilities. That is one of the great costs of a prolonged recession. It leads to more downward mobility than anyone ever wants to see. And that's what happened during the Great Depression. Lots of people who had high ambitions who ended up having to settle for something less. And as recessions go on for a long period of time, as this one has, that happens more and more. So I think we are in for a period of frustration. We're already in one, in which our ambitions and what the world will deliver are quite far apart.
Yeah. Our guest, Catherine Newman, she's professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. If you'd like to read more on the subject, look for her recent book. The title is The Accordion Family, and it is published by the Beacon Press. And Professor Newman, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue. So please stay tuned.
Good morning, great Satan of America. How are you? I am fine, thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Sacha Baron Cohen talks about his comedy, The Dictator, in which he plays the corrupt, tyrannical ruler of a fictional oil-rich nation in Northern Africa. It's out on DVD next week. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey heading into the final 3 hours of trading for this week. Soybean and wheat futures are generally higher. The nearby corn future is showing some very light strength on most of the rest of the corn contracts are to the downside. Wheat continues to be the leader to the upside as the trade continues to debate just how small the Black Sea's area wheat exports will be in the new marketing year. Soybeans are higher as we continue to debate crop uncertainties despite the weather we've seen, with some more consistent rains coming across the U.S. in the last week or so. There's questions about whether we'll see additional pods, and there's also addition about how much the rain is helping pod fill the existing pod supply. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat, 886 and three quarters, up 14 and a quarter. March of 13 at 921, up 13. September wheat in Chicago, 877 and a quarter, up 15 and a half. March, 903 and three quarters, up 12 and a quarter. September corn, 779 and three quarters, up 2. December unchanged on the days at 807 and a half. It's traded as high today as 813 and a quarter. Needs a number around that benchmark in order